Chapter 2. Questioning the Foundations of Traditional Safety Engineering. It's never what we don't know that stops us. It's what we do know that just ain't so. Paradigm changes necessarily start with questioning the basic assumptions underlying what we do today. Many beliefs about safety and why accidents occur have been widely accepted without question. This chapter examines and questions some of the most important assumptions about the cause of accidents and how to prevent them that just ain't so. There is, of course, some truth in each of these assumptions, and many were true for the systems of the past. The real question is whether they still fit today's complex socio-technical systems and what new assumptions need to be substituted or added. Section 2.1. Confusing safety with reliability. Assumption 1. Safety is increased by increasing system or component reliability. If components or systems do not fail, then accidents will not occur. This assumption is one of the most pervasive in engineering and other fields. The problem is that it's not true. Safety and reliability are different properties. One does not imply nor require the other. A system can be reliable but unsafe. It can also be safe but unreliable. In some cases, these two properties even conflict. That is, making the system safer may decrease reliability and enhancing reliability may decrease safety. The confusion on this point is exemplified by the primary focus on failure events in most accident and incident analysis. Some researchers in organizational aspects of safety also make this mistake by suggesting that high reliability organizations will be safe. Because this assumption about the equivalence between safety and reliability is so widely held, the distinction between these two properties needs to be carefully considered. First, let's consider accidents where none of the system components fail. Reliable but unsafe. In complex systems, accidents often result from interactions among components that are all satisfying their individual requirements, that is, they have not failed. The loss of the Mars Polar Lander was attributed to noise spurious signals generated when the landing legs were deployed during the spacecraft's descent to the planet's surface. This noise was normal and expected and did not represent a failure in the landing leg system. The onboard software interpreted these signals as an indication that landing had occurred, which the software engineers were told such signals would indicate and shut down the descent engines prematurely, causing the spacecraft to crash into the Mars surface. The landing legs and the software performed correctly as specified in their requirements and reliably, but the accident occurred because the system designers did not account for all the potential interactions between landing leg deployment and the descent engine control software. The Mars Polar Lander loss is a component interaction accident. Such accidents arise in the interactions among system components, electromechanical, digital, human, and social, rather than in the failure of individual components. In contrast, the other main type of accident, a component failure accident, results from component failures, including the possibility of multiple and cascading failures. In component failure accidents, the failures are usually treated as random phenomena. In component interaction accidents, there may be no failures and the system design errors giving rise to unsafe behavior are not random events. A failure in engineering can be defined as the non-performance or inability of a component or system to perform its intended function. Intended function and thus failure is defined with respect to the component's behavioral requirements. If the behavior of a component satisfies its specified requirements, such as turning off the descent engines when a signal from the landing legs is received, even though the requirements may include behavior that is undesirable from a larger system context, that component has not failed. Component failure accidents have received the most attention in engineering, but component interaction accidents are becoming more common as the complexity of our system designs increases. In the past, our designs were more intellectually manageable, and the potential interactions among components could be thoroughly planned, understood, anticipated, and guarded against. In addition, thorough testing was possible and could be used to eliminate design errors before use. Modern, high-tech systems no longer have these properties, and system design errors are increasingly the cause of major accidents, even when all the components have operated reliably. That is, the components have not failed. Consider another example of a component interaction accident that occurred in a batch chemical reactor in England. The design of this system is shown in Figure 2.1. The computer was responsible for controlling the flow of catalyst into the reactor and also the flow of water into the reflux condenser to cool off the reaction. Additionally, sensor inputs to the computer were supposed to warn of any problems in various parts of the plant. The programmers were told that if a fault occurred in the plant, they were to leave all controlled variables as they were and to sound an alarm. On one occasion, the computer received a signal indicating a low oil level in a gearbox. The computer reacted as the requirements specified. It sounded an alarm and left everything as it was. By coincidence, a catalyst had just been added to the reactor, but the computer had only started to increase the cooling rate of flow to the reflux condenser. The flow was therefore kept at a low rate. The reactor overheated, the relief valve lifted, and the content of the reactor was discharged into the atmosphere. Note that there were no component failures involved in this accident. The individual components, including the software, worked as specified, but together they created a hazardous system state. The problem was in the overall system design. Merely increasing the reliability of the individual components or protecting against their failure would not have prevented this accident because none of the components failed. Prevention required identifying and eliminating or mitigating unsafe interactions among the system components. High component reliability does not prevent component interaction accidents. Safe but unreliable. Accidents like the Mars Polar Lander or the British Batch Chemical Reactor losses, where the cause lies in dysfunctional interactions of non-failing, reliable components, i.e. the problem is in the overall system design. Illustrate reliable components in an unsafe system. There can also be safe systems with unreliable components if the system is designed and operated so that component failures do not create hazardous system states. Design techniques to prevent accidents are described in Chapter 16 of Safeware. One obvious example is systems that are fail-safe, that is, they are designed to fail into a safe state. For an example of behavior that is unreliable but safe, consider human operators. If operators do not follow the specified procedures, then they are not operating reliably. In some cases, that can lead to an accident. In other cases, it may prevent an accident when the specified procedures turn out to be unsafe under the particular circumstances existing at that time. Examples abound of operators ignoring prescribed procedures in order to prevent an accident. At the same time, accidents have resulted precisely because the operators did follow the predetermined instructions provided to them in their training, such as at Three Mile Island. When the results of deviating from procedures are positive, operators are lauded, but when the results are negative, they are punished for being unreliable. In the successful case, deviating from specified procedures averts an accident. Their behavior is unreliable but safe. It satisfies the behavioral safety constraints for the system, but not individual reliability requirements with respect to following specified procedures. It may be helpful at this point to provide some additional definitions. Reliability in engineering is defined as the probability that something satisfies its specified behavioral requirements over time and under given conditions. That is, it does not fail. Reliability is often quantified as mean time between failure. Every hardware component and most humans can be made to break or fail given some set of conditions or a long enough time. The limitations in time and operating conditions in the definition are required to differentiate between one unreliability under the assumed operating conditions and two situations where no component or component design could have continued to operate. if a driver engages the brakes of a car too late to avoid hitting the car in front, we would not say that the brakes failed because they did not stop the car under circumstances for which they were not designed. The brakes, in this case, were not unreliable. They operated reliably, but the requirements for safety went beyond the capabilities of the brake design. Failure and reliability are always related to requirements and assumed operating environmental conditions. If there are no requirements either specified or assumed, then there can be no failure, as any behavior is acceptable and no unreliability. Safety, in contrast, is defined as the absence of accidents, where an accident is an event involving an unplanned and unacceptable loss. To increase safety, the focus should be on eliminating or preventing hazards, not eliminating failures. Making all the components highly reliable will not necessarily make the system safe. Conflicts between safety and reliability. At this point, you may be convinced that reliable components are not enough for system safety. But surely, if the system as a whole is reliable, it will be safe, and vice versa. If the system is unreliable, it will be unsafe. That is, reliability and safety are the same thing at the system level, aren't they? This common assumption is also untrue. A chemical plant may very reliably manufacture chemicals, while occasionally are even continually releasing toxic materials into the surrounding environment. The plant is reliable but unsafe. Not only are safety and reliability not the same thing, but they sometimes conflict. Increasing reliability may decrease safety, and increasing safety may decrease reliability. Consider the following simple example in physical design. Increasing the working pressure to burst ratio, essentially the strength of a tank, will make the tank more reliable. That is, it will increase the mean time between failure. When a failure does occur, however, more serious damage may result because of the higher pressure at the time of the rupture. Reliability and safety may also conflict in engineering design, when a choice has to be made between retreating to a fail-safe state and protecting people and property versus attempting to continue to achieve the system objectives but with increased risk of an accident. Understanding the conflicts between reliability and safety requires distinguishing between requirements and constraints. Requirements are derived from the mission or reason for the existence of the organization. The mission of the chemical plant is to produce chemicals. Constraints represent acceptable ways the system or organization can achieve the mission goals. Not exposing bystanders to toxins and not polluting the environment are constraints on the way the mission producing chemicals can be achieved. While in some systems safety is part of the mission or reason for existence, such as air traffic control or healthcare, in others safety is not the mission but instead is a constraint on how the mission can be achieved. The best way to ensure the constraints are enforced in such a system may be not to build or operate the system at all. Not building a nuclear bomb is the surest protection against accidental detonation. We may be unwilling to make that compromise, but some compromise is almost always necessary. The most effective design protections, besides not building the bomb at all against accidental detonation, also decrease the likelihood of detonation when it is required. Not only do safety constraints sometimes conflict with mission goals, but the safety requirements may even conflict among themselves. One safety constraint on an automated train door system, for example, is that the doors must not open unless the train is stopped and properly aligned with a station platform. Another safety constraint is that the doors must open anywhere for emergency evacuation. Resolving these conflicts is one of the important steps in safety and system engineering. Even systems with mission goals that include assuring safety, such as air traffic control ATC, usually have other conflicting goals. ATC systems commonly have the mission to both increase system throughput and ensure safety. One way to increase throughput is to decrease safety margins by operating aircraft closer together. Keeping the aircraft separated adequately to assure acceptable risk may decrease system throughput. There are always multiple goals and constraints for any system. The challenge in engineering design and risk management is to identify and analyze the conflicts, to make appropriate trade-offs among the conflicting requirements and constraints, and to find ways to increase system safety without decreasing system reliability. Safety versus reliability at the organizational level. So far, the discussion has focused on safety versus reliability at the physical level. But what about the social and organizational levels above the physical system? Are safety and reliability the same here as implied by high reliability organization HRO advocates who suggest that high reliability organizations HROs will be safe? The answer, again, is no. Figure 2-2 shows Rasmussen's analysis of the Zeebrugg ferry mishap. Some background is necessary to understand the figure. On the day the ferry capsized, the Herald of Free Enterprise was working the route between Dover and the Belgian port of Bruges Zeebrugg. This route was not her normal one, and the linkspan 2 at Zeebrugg had not been designed specifically for the Spirit type of ships. The link span used spanned a single deck and so could not be used to load decks E and G simultaneously. The ramp could also not be raised high enough to meet the level of deck E due to the high spring tides at that time. This limitation was commonly known and was overcome by filling the forward ballast tanks to lower the ferry's bow in the water. The Herald was due to be modified during its refit later that year to overcome this limitation in the ship's design. Before dropping moorings, it was normal practice for a member of the crew, the assistant boatswain, to close the ferry doors. The first officer also remained on deck to ensure they were closed before returning to the wheelhouse. On the day of the accident, in order to keep on schedule, the first officer returned to the wheelhouse before the ship dropped its moorings, which was common practice, leaving the closing of the doors to the assistant boatswain, who had taken a short break after cleaning the car deck upon arrival at Zeebrugg. He had returned to his cabin and was still asleep when the ship left the dock. The captain could only assume that the doors had been closed because he could not see them from the wheelhouse due to their construction, and there was no indicator light in the wheelhouse to show door position. Why nobody else closed the door is unexplained in the accident report. Other factors also contributed to the loss. One was the depth of the water. If the ship's speed had been below 18 knots 33 km/h and the ship had not been in shallow water, it was speculated in the accident report that the people on the car deck would probably have had time to notice the bow doors were open and close them. But open bow doors were not alone enough to cause the final capsizing. A few years earlier, one of the Herald's sister ships sailed from Dover to Zeebrugg with the bow doors open and made it to her destination without incident. Almost all ships are divided into watertight compartments below the waterline so that in the event of flooding, the water will be confined to one compartment, keeping the ship afloat. The Herald's design had an open car deck with no divisors, allowing vehicles to drive in and out easily, but this design allowed water to flood the car deck. As the ferry turned, the water on the car deck moved to one side and the vessel capsized. 193 passengers and crew were killed. In this accident, those making decisions about vessel design, harbor design, cargo management, passenger management, traffic scheduling, and vessel operation were unaware of the impact side effects of their decisions on the others and the overall impact on the process leading to the ferry accident. Each operated reliably in terms of making decisions based on the information they had. Bottom-up decentralized decision-making can lead and has led to major Archie Dents in complex socio-technical systems. Each local decision may be correct in the limited context in which it was made but lead to an accident when the independent decisions and organizational behaviors interact in dysfunctional ways. Safety is a system property, not a component property, and must be controlled at the system level, not the component level. We return to this topic in Chapter 3. Assumption 1 is clearly and true. A new assumption needs to be substituted. New Assumption 1. High reliability is neither necessary nor sufficient for safety. B. Building safer systems requires going beyond the usual focus on component failure and reliability to focus on system hazards and eliminating or reducing their occurrence. This fact has important implications for analyzing and designing for safety. Bottom-up reliability engineering analysis techniques, such as failure modes and effects analysis FMEA, are not appropriate for safety analysis. Even top-down techniques such as fault trees, if they focus on component failure, are not adequate. Something else is needed. Section 2.2. Modeling accident causation as event chains. Assumption 2. Accidents are caused by chains of directly related events. We can understand accidents and assess risk by looking at the chain of events leading to the loss. Some of the most important assumptions in safety lie in our models of how the world works. Models are important because they provide a means for understanding phenomena like accidents or potentially hazardous system behavior and for recording that understanding in a way that can be communicated to others. A particular type of model, an accident causality model or accident model for short, underlies all efforts to engineer for safety. Our accident models provide the foundation for 1. Investigating and analyzing the cause of accidents, 2. Designing to prevent future losses, and 3. Assessing the risk associated with using the systems and products we create. Accident models explain why accidents occur, and they determine the approaches we take to prevent them. While you might not be consciously aware you are using a model when engaged in these activities, some perhaps subconscious model of the phenomenon is always part of the process. All models are abstractions. They simplify the thing being modeled by abstracting away what are assumed to be irrelevant details and focusing on the features of the phenomenon that are judged to be the most relevant. Selecting some factors as relevant and others as irrelevant is, in most cases, arbitrary and entirely the choice of the modeler. That choice, however, is critical in determining the usefulness and accuracy of the model in predicting future events. An underlying assumption of all accident models is that there are common patterns in accidents and that they are not simply random events. Accident models impose patterns on accidents and influence the factors considered in any safety analysis. Because the accident model influences what cause S is ascribed to an accident, the countermeasures taken to prevent future accidents, and the evaluation of the risk in operating a system, the power and features of the accident model used will greatly affect our ability to identify and control hazards and thus prevent accidents. The earliest formal accident models came from industrial safety, sometimes called occupational safety, and reflect the factors inherent in protecting workers from injury or illness. Later, these same models or variants of them were applied to the engineering and operation of complex technical and social systems. At the beginning, the focus in industrial accident prevention was on unsafe conditions such as open blades and unprotected belts. While this emphasis on preventing unsafe conditions was very successful in reducing workplace injuries, the decrease naturally started to slow down as the most obvious hazards were eliminated. The emphasis then shifted to unsafe acts. Accidents began to be regarded as someone's fault rather than as an event that could have been prevented by some change in the plant or product. Heinrich's domino model, published in 1931, was one of the first published general accident models and was very influential in shifting the emphasis in safety to human error. Heinrich compared the general sequence of accidents to 5 dominoes standing on end in a line, figure 2-3. When the first domino falls, it automatically knocks down its neighbor and so on until the injury occurs. In any accident sequence, according to this model, ancestry or social environment leads to a fault of a person, which is the proximate reason for an unsafe act or condition, mechanical or physical, which results in an accident which leads to an injury. In 1976, Bird and Loftus extended the basic domino model to include management decisions as a factor in accidents. 1. Lack of control by management, permitting. 2. basic causes, personal and job factors that lead to. 3. Immediate causes, substandard practices / conditions / errors, which are the proximate cause of. 4. An accident or incident, which results in. 5. A loss. In the same year, Adams suggested a different management-augmented model that included. 1. Management structure. Objectives, organization, and operations. 2. Operational errors. Management or supervisory behavior. 3. Tactical errors. Caused by employee behavior and work conditions. 4. Accident or incident. 5. Injury or damage to persons or property. Reason reinvented the domino model 20 years later in what he called the Swiss cheese model, with layers of Swiss cheese substituted for dominoes and the layers of dominoes labeled as layers of defense 3 that have failed. The basic domino model is inadequate for complex systems and other models were developed. See Safeware, Chapter 10. But the assumption that there is a single or root cause of an accident unfortunately persists, as does the idea of dominoes or layers of Swiss cheese and chains of failures, each directly causing or leading to the next one in the chain. It also lives on in the emphasis on human error in identifying accident causes. The most common accident models today explain accidents in terms of multiple events sequenced as a forward chain over time. The events included almost always involve some type of failure event or human error, or they are energy related, for example, an explosion. The chains may be branching as in fault trees, or there may be multiple chains synchronized by time or common events. Lots of notations have been developed to represent the events in a graphical form, but the underlying model is the same. Figure 2-4 shows an example for the rupture of a pressurized tank. The use of event chain models of causation has important implications for the way engineers design for safety. If an accident is caused by a chain of events, then the most obvious preventive measure is to break the chain before the loss occurs. Because the most common events considered in these models are component failures, preventive measures tend to be focused on preventing failure events, increasing component integrity, or introducing redundancy to reduce the likelihood of the event occurring. If corrosion can be prevented in the tank rupture accident, for example, then the tank rupture is averted. Figure 2-5 is annotated with mitigation measures designed to break the chain. These mitigation measures are examples of the most common design techniques based on event chain models of accidents, such as barriers, for example, preventing the contact of moisture with the metal used in the tank by coating it with plate carbon steel, or providing mesh screens to contain fragments, interlocks using a burst diaphragm, overdesign increasing the metal thickness, and operational procedures reducing the amount of pressure as the tank ages. For this simple example involving only physical failures, designing to prevent such failures works well. But even this simple example omits any consideration of factors indirectly related to the events in the chain. An example of a possible indirect or systemic example is competitive or financial pressures to increase efficiency that could lead to not following the plan to reduce the operating pressure as the tank ages. A second factor might be changes over time to the plant design that require workers to spend time near the tank while it is pressurized. Formal and informal notations for representing the event chain may contain only the events, or they may also contain the conditions that led to the events. Events create conditions that, along with existing conditions, lead to events that create new conditions, and so on. Figure 2-6. The tank corrodes, event leads to a corrosion exists in tank condition, which leads to a metal weakens event, which leads to a weakened metal condition, and so forth. The difference between events and conditions is that events are limited in time, while conditions persist until some event occurs that results in new or changed conditions. For example, the three conditions that must exist before a flammable mixture will explode the event are the flammable gases or vapors themselves, air, and a source of ignition. Any one or two of these may exist for a period of time before the other S occurs and leads to the explosion. An event the explosion creates new conditions, such as uncontrolled energy or toxic chemicals in the air. Causality models based on event chains or dominoes or layers of Swiss cheese are simple and therefore appealing, but they are too simple and do not include what is needed to understand why accidents occur and how to prevent them. Some important limitations include requiring direct causality relationships, subjectivity in selecting the events to include subjectivity in identifying chaining conditions, and exclusion of systemic factors. Section 221. Direct causality. The causal relationships between the events in event chain models or between dominoes or Swiss cheese slices are required to be direct and linear, representing the notion that the preceding event must have occurred and the linking conditions must have been present for the subsequent event to occur. If event A had not occurred, then the following event B would not have occurred. As such, event chain models encourage limited notions of linear causality, and it is difficult or impossible to incorporate non-linear relationships. Consider the statement smoking causes lung cancer. Such a statement would not be allowed in the event chain model of causality because there is no direct relationship between the two. Many smokers do not get lung cancer, and some people who get lung cancer are not smokers. It is widely accepted, however, that there is some relationship between the two, although it may be quite complex and non-linear. In addition to limitations in the types of causality considered, the causal factors identified using event chain models depend on the events that are considered and on the selection of the conditions that link the events. Other than the physical events immediately preceding or directly involved in the loss, however, the choice of events to include is subjective and the condition selected to explain the events is even more so. Each of these two limitations is considered in turn. Section 222. Subjectivity in selecting events. The selection of events to include in an event chain is dependent on the stopping rule used to determine how far back the sequence of explanatory events goes. Although the first event in the chain is often labeled the initiating event or root cause, the selection of an initiating event is arbitrary and previous events and conditions could always be added. Sometimes the initiating event is selected. The backward chaining stops because it represents a type of event that is familiar and thus acceptable as an explanation for the accident, or it is a deviation from a standard. In other cases, the initiating event or root cause is chosen because it is the first event in the backward chain for which it is felt that something can be done for correction. For the backward chaining may also stop because the causal path disappears due to lack of information. Rasmussen suggests that a practical explanation for why actions by operators actively involved in the dynamic flow of events are so often identified as the cause of an accident is the difficulty in continuing the backtracking through a human. A final reason why a root cause may be selected is that it is politically acceptable as the identified cause. Other events or explanations may be excluded or not examined in depth because they raise issues that are embarrassing to the organization or its contractors or are politically unacceptable. The accident report on a friendly fire shootdown of a U.S. Army helicopter over the Iraqi Nofli zone in 1994, for example, describes the chain of events leading to the shootdown. Included in these events is the fact that the helicopter pilots did not change to the radio frequency required in the Nofli zone when they entered it. They stayed on the en route frequency. Stopping at this event in the chain, which the official report does, it appears that the helicopter pilots were partially at fault for the loss by not following radio procedures. An independent account of the accident, however, notes that the U.S. commander of the operation had made an exception about the radio frequency to be used by the helicopters in order to mitigate a different safety concern, see Chapter 5, and therefore the pilots were simply following orders when they did not switch to the required frequency. The command to the helicopter pilots not to follow official radio procedures is not included in the chain of events provided in the official government accident report, but it suggests a very different understanding of the role of the helicopter pilots in the loss. In addition to root cause or causes, some events or conditions may be identified as proximate or direct causes while others are labeled as contributory. There is no more basis for this distinction than the selection of a root cause. Making such distinctions between causes or limiting the factors considered can be a hindrance in learning from and preventing future accidents. Consider the following aircraft examples. In the crash of an American Airlines DC-10 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport in 1979, the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board NTSB blamed only a maintenance-induced crack, and not also a design error that allowed the slats to retract if the wing was punctured. Because of this omission, McDonnell Douglas was not required to change the design, leading to future accidents related to the same design flaw. Similar omissions of causal factors in aircraft accidents have occurred more recently. One example is the crash of a China Airlines A300 on April 26, 1994, while approaching the Nagoya, Japan, airport. One of the factors involved in the accident was the design of the flight control computer software. Previous incidents with the same type of aircraft had led to a service bulletin being issued for a modification of the two flight control computers to fix the problem. But because the computer problem had not been labeled a cause of the previous incidents for perhaps at least partially political reasons, the modification was labeled recommended rather than mandatory. China Airlines concluded, as a result, that the implementation of the changes to the computers was not urgent and decided to delay modification until the next time the flight computers on the plane needed repair. Because of that delay, 264 passengers and crew died. In another DC-10 saga, explosive decompression played a critical role in a near-miss over Windsor, Ontario. An American Airlines DC-10 lost part of its passenger floor, and thus all of the control cables that ran through it when a cargo door opened in flight in June 1972. Thanks to the extraordinary skill and poise of the pilot, Bryce McCormick, the plane landed safely. In a remarkable coincidence, McCormick had trained himself to fly the plane using only the engines because he had been concerned about a decompression-caused collapse of the floor. After this close call, McCormick recommended that every DC-10 pilot be informed of the consequences of explosive decompression and trained in the flying techniques that he and his crew an exception about the radio frequency to be used by the helicopters in order to mitigate a different safety concern, see Chapter 5, and therefore the pilots were simply following orders when they did not switch to the required frequency. The command to the helicopter pilots not to follow official radio procedures is not included in the chain of events provided in the official government accident report, but it suggests a very different understanding of the role of the helicopter pilots in the loss. In addition to a root cause or causes, some events or conditions may be identified as proximate or direct causes while others are labeled as contributory. There is no more basis for this distinction than the selection of a root cause. Making such distinctions between causes or limiting the factors considered can be a hindrance in learning from and preventing future accidents. Consider the following aircraft examples. In the crash of an American Airlines DC-10 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport in 1979, the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board NTSB blamed only a maintenance-induced crack, and not also a design error that allowed the slats to retract if the wing was punctured. Because of this omission, McDonnell Douglas was not required to change the design, leading to future accidents related to the same design flaw. Similar omissions of causal factors in aircraft accidents have occurred more recently. One example is the crash of a China Airlines A300 on April 26, 1994, while approaching the Nagoya, Japan, airport. One of the factors involved in the accident was the design of the flight control computer software. Previous incidents with the same type of aircraft had led to a service bulletin being issued for a modification of the two flight control computers to fix the problem. But because the computer problem had not been labeled a cause of the previous incidents for perhaps at least partially political reasons, the modification was labeled recommended rather than mandatory. China Airlines concluded, as a result, that the implementation of the changes to the computers was not urgent and decided to delay modification until the next time the flight computers on the plane needed repair. Because of that delay, 264 passengers and crew died. In another DC-10 saga, explosive decompression played a critical role in a near-miss over Windsor, Ontario. An American Airlines DC-10 lost part of its passenger floor, and thus all of the control cables that ran through it, when a cargo door opened in flight in June 1972. Thanks to the extraordinary skill and poise of the pilot, Bryce McCormick, the plane landed safely. In a remarkable coincidence, McCormick had trained himself to fly the plane using only the engines because he had been concerned about a decompression-caused collapse of the floor. After this close call, McCormick recommended that every DC-10 pilot be informed of the consequences of explosive decompression and trained in the flying techniques that he and his crew had used to save their passengers and aircraft. FAA investigators, the National Transportation Safety Board, and engineers at a subcontractor to McDonnell Douglas that designed the fuselage of the plane, all recommended changes in the design of the aircraft. Instead, McDonnell Douglas attributed the Windsor incident totally to human error on the part of the baggage handler responsible for closing the cargo compartment door, convenient event in the event chain, and not to any error on the part of their designers or engineers, and decided all they had to do was to come up with a fix that would prevent baggage handlers from forcing the door. One of the discoveries after the Windsor incident was that the door could be improperly closed, but the external signs, such as the position of the external handle, made it appear to be closed properly. In addition, this incident proved that the cockpit warning system could fail, and the crew would then not know that the plane was taking off without a properly closed door. The aviation industry does not normally receive such manifest warnings of basic design flaws in an aircraft without cost to human life. Windsor deserved to be celebrated as an exceptional case when every life was saved through a combination of crew skill and the sheer luck that the plane was so lightly loaded. If there had been more passengers and thus more weight, damage to the control cables would undoubtedly have been more severe, and it is highly questionable if any amount of skill could have saved the plane. Almost 2 years later, in March 1974, a fully loaded Turkish Airlines DC-10 crashed near Paris, resulting in 346 deaths. One of the worst accidents in aviation history. Once again, the cargo door had opened in flight, causing the cabin floor to collapse, severing the flight control cables. Immediately after the accident, Sanford McDonnell stated the official McDonnell Douglas position that once again placed the blame on the baggage handler and the ground crew. This time, however, the FAA finally ordered modifications to all DC-10s that eliminated the hazard. In addition, an FAA regulation issued in July 1975 required all wide-bodied jets to be able to tolerate a hole in the fuselage of 20 square feet. By labeling the root cause in the event chain as baggage handler error and attempting only to eliminate that event or link in the chain rather than the basic engineering design flaws, fixes that could have prevented the Paris crash were not made. Until we do a better job of identifying causal factors in accidents, we will continue to have a necessary repetition of incidents and accidents. Footnote. As an example, a NASA Procedures and Guidelines document NPG 8621 Draft 1 defines a root cause as along a chain of events leading to a mishap, the first causal action or failure to act that could have been controlled systematically either by policy.practice.procedure or individual adherence to policy.practice.procedure. Section 223. Subjectivity in selecting the chaining conditions in addition to subjectivity in selecting the events and the root cause event, the links between the events that are chosen to explain them are subjective and subject to bias. Leplat notes that the links are justified by knowledge or rules of different types, including physical and organizational knowledge. The same event can give rise to different types of links according to the mental representations the analyst has of the production of this event. When several types of rules are possible, the analyst will apply those that agree with his or her mental model of the situation. Consider, for example, the loss of an American Airlines B-757 near Cali, Colombia, in 1995. Two significant events in this loss were one. Pilot asks for clearance to take the ROZO approach followed later by two. Pilot types R into the FMS. 5. In fact, the pilot should have typed the four letters ROZO instead of R. The latter was the symbol for a different radio beacon called Romeo near Bogota. As a result, the aircraft incorrectly turned toward mountainous terrain. While these events are non-controversial, the link between the two events could be explained by any of the following. Pilot error. In the rush to start the descent, the pilot executed a change of course without verifying its effect on the flight path. Crew procedure error. In the rush to start the descent, the captain entered the name of the waypoint without normal verification from the other pilot. Approach chart and FMS. Inconsistencies. The identifier used to identify ROZO on the approach chart R did not match the identifier used to call up ROZO in the FMS. FMS. Design deficiency. The FMS did not provide the pilot with feedback that choosing the first identifier listed on the display was not the closest beacon having that identifier. American Airlines training deficiency. The pilots flying into South America were not warned about duplicate beacon identifiers nor adequately trained on the logic and priorities used in the FMS on the aircraft. Manufacturer deficiency. Jeppesen Sanderson did not inform airlines operating FMS-equipped aircraft of the differences between navigation information provided by Jeppesen Sanderson Flight Management System navigation databases and Jeppesen Sanderson approach charts or the logic and priorities employed in the display of electronic FMS navigation information. International standards deficiency. No single worldwide standard provides unified criteria for the providers of electronic navigation databases used in flight management systems. The selection of the linking condition or events will greatly influence the cause ascribed to the accident, yet in the example all are plausible and each could serve as an explanation of the event sequence. The choice may reflect more on the person or group making the selection than on the accident itself. In fact, understanding this accident and learning enough from it to prevent future accidents requires identifying all of these factors to explain the incorrect input. The accident model used should encourage and guide a comprehensive analysis at multiple technical and social system levels. Footnote. An FMS is an automated flight management system that assists the pilots in various ways. In this case, it was being used to provide navigation information. Section 224. Discounting SysMic factors. The problem with event chain models is not simply that the selection of the events to include and the labeling of some of them as causes are arbitrary, or that the selection of which conditions to include is also arbitrary and usually incomplete. Even more important is that viewing accidents as chains of events and conditions may limit understanding and learning from the loss and omit causal factors that cannot be included in an event chain. Event chains developed to explain an accident usually concentrate on the proximate events immediately preceding the loss. but the foundation for an accident is often laid years before. One event simply triggers the loss, but if that event had not happened, another one would have led to a loss. The Bhopal disaster provides a good example. The release of methyl isocyanate, MIC, from the Union Carbide chemical plant in Bhopal, India, in December 1984 has been called the worst industrial accident in history. Conservative estimates point to 2,000 fatalities, 10,000 permanent disabilities including blindness, and 200,000 injuries. The Indian government blamed the accident on human error. The improper cleaning of a pipe at the plant. A relatively new worker was assigned to wash out some pipes and filters, which were clogged. MIC produces large amounts of heat when in contact with water, and the worker properly closed the valves to isolate the MIC tanks from the pipes and filters being washed. Nobody, however, inserted a required safety disc called a slip blind to back up the valves in case they leaked. A chain of events describing the accident mechanism for Bhopal might include. E1. Worker washes pipes without inserting a slip blind. E2. Water leaks into MIC tank. E3. Explosion occurs. E4. Relief valve opens. E5. MIC vented into air. E6. Wind carries MIC into populated area around plant. Both Union Carbide and the Indian government blamed the worker washing the pipes for the accident. 6. A different operator error might be identified as the root cause initiating event if the chain is followed back farther. The worker who had been assigned the task of washing the pipes reportedly knew that the valves leaked, but he did not check to see whether the pipe was properly isolated because, he said, it was not his job to do so. Inserting the safety discs was the job of the maintenance department, but the maintenance sheet contained no instruction to insert this disc. The pipe washing operation should have been supervised by the second shift supervisor, but that position had been eliminated in a cost-cutting effort. So the root cause might instead have been assigned to the person responsible for inserting the slip blind or to the lack of a second shift supervisor. But the selection of a stopping point and the specific operator action to label as the root cause and operator actions are almost always selected as root causes is not the real problem here. The problem is the oversimplification implicit in using a chain of events to understand why this accident occurred. Given the design and operating conditions of the plant, an accident was waiting to happen. However got in, it would not have caused the severe explosion had the refrigeration unit not been disconnected and drain of freon, or had the gauges been properly working and monitored, or had various steps been taken at the first smell of MIC instead of being put off until after the tea break, or had the scrubber been in service, or had the water sprays been designed to go high enough to douse the emissions, or had the flare towel been working and been of sufficient capacity to handle a large excursion. It is not uncommon for a company to turn off passive safety devices such as refrigeration units to save money. The operating manual specified that the refrigeration unit must be operating whenever MIC was in the system. The chemical has to be maintained at a temperature no higher than 5 degrees Celsius to avoid uncontrolled reactions. A high temperature alarm was to sound if the MIC reached 11 degrees. The refrigeration unit was turned off, however, to save money, and the MIC was usually stored at nearly 20 degrees. The plant management adjusted the threshold of the alarm, according to, from 11 degrees to 20 degrees, and logging of tank temperatures was halted, thus eliminating the possibility of an early warning of rising temperatures. Gauges at plants are frequently out of service. At the Bhopal facility, there were few alarms or interlock devices in critical locations that might have warned operators of abnormal conditions. A system design deficiency. Other protection devices at the plant had inadequate design thresholds. The vent scrubber, had it worked, was designed to neutralize only small quantities of gas at fairly low pressures and temperatures. The pressure of the escaping gas during the accident exceeded the scrubber's design by nearly 2.5 times, and the temperature of the escaping gas was at least 80 degrees Celsius more than the scrubber could handle. Similarly, the flare tower, which was supposed to burn off released vapor, was totally inadequate to deal with the estimated 40 tons of MIC that escaped during the accident. In addition, the MIC was vented from the vent stack 108 feet above the ground, well above the height of the water curtain intended to knock down the gas. The water curtain reached only 40 to 50 feet above the ground. The water jets could reach as high as 115 feet, but only if operated individually. Leaks were routine occurrences and the reasons for them were seldom investigated. Problems were either fixed without further examination or were ignored. A safety audit 2 years earlier by a team from Union Carbide had noted many safety problems at the plant, including several involved in the accident, such as filter cleaning operations without using slip blinds, leaking valves, the possibility of contaminating the tank with material from the vent gas scrubber, and bad pressure gauges. The safety auditors had recommended increasing the capability of the water curtain and had pointed out that the alarm at the flare tower from which the MIC leaked was non-operational, and thus any leak could go unnoticed for a long time. None of the recommended changes were made. There is debate about whether the audit information was fully shared with the Union Carbide India subsidiary and about who was responsible for making sure changes were made. In any event, there was no follow-up to make sure that the problems identified in the audit had been corrected. A year before the accident, the chemical engineer managing the MIC plant resigned because he disapproved of falling safety standards, and still no changes were made. He was replaced by an electrical engineer. Measures for dealing with a chemical release once it occurred were no better. Alarms at the plant sounded so often the siren went off 20 to 30 times a week for various purposes that an actual alert could not be distinguished from routine events or practice alerts. Ironically, the warning siren was not turned on until 2 hours after the MIC leak was detected and after almost all the injuries had occurred, and then was turned off after only 5 minutes, which was company policy. Moreover, the NUMA OOS practice alerts did not seem to be effective in preparing for an emergency. When the danger during the release became known, many employees ran from the contaminated areas of the plant, totally ignoring the buses that were sitting idle ready to evacuate workers and nearby residents. Plant workers had only a bare minimum of emergency equipment. A shortage of oxygen masks, for example, was discovered after the accident started, and they had almost no knowledge or training about how to handle non-routine events. The police were not notified when the CHEMICAL release began. In fact, when called by police and reporters, plant spokesman first denied the accident and then claimed that MIC was not dangerous. Nor was the surrounding community warned of the dangers, before or during the release, or informed of the simple precautions that could have saved them from lethal exposure, such as putting a wet cloth over their face and closing their eyes. If the community had been alerted and provided with this simple information, many, if not most, lives would have been saved and injuries prevented. Some of the reasons why the poor conditions in the plant were allowed to persist are financial. Demand for MIC had dropped sharply after 1981, leading to reductions in production and pressure on the company to cut costs. The plant was operating at less than half capacity when the accident occurred. Union Carbide put pressure on the Indian management to reduce losses, but gave no specific details on how to achieve the reductions. In response, the maintenance and operating personnel were cut in half. Maintenance procedures were severely cut back and the shift relieving system was suspended. If no replacement showed up at the end of the shift, the following shift went unmanned. The person responsible for inserting the slip blind in the pipe had not showed up for his shift. Top management justified the cuts as merely reducing avoidable and wasteful expenditures without affecting overall safety. As the plant lost money, many of the skilled workers left for more secure jobs. They either were not replaced or were replaced by unskilled workers. When the plant was first built, operators and technicians had the equivalent of 2 years of college education in chemistry or chemical engineering. In addition, Union Carbide provided them with 6 months training. When the plant began to lose money, educational standards and staffing levels were reportedly reduced. In the past, UC flew plant personnel to West Virginia for intensive training and had teams of U.S. engineers make regular on-site safety inspections. But by 1982, financial pressures led UC to give up direct supervision of safety at the plant, even though it retained general financial and technical control. No American advisors were resident at Bhopal after 1982. Management and labor problems followed the financial losses. Morale at the plant was low. There was widespread belief among employees that the management had taken drastic and imprudent measures to cut costs and that attention to details that ensure safe operation were absent. These are only a few of the factors involved in this catastrophe, which also include other technical and human errors within the plant, design errors, management negligence, regulatory deficiencies on the part of the US and Indian governments, and general agricultural and technology transfer policies related to the reason they were making such a dangerous chemical in India in the first place. Any one of these perspectives or causes is inadequate by itself to understand the accident and to prevent future ones. In particular, identifying only operator error or sabotage as the root cause of the accident ignores most of the opportunities for the prevention of similar accidents in the future. Many of the systemic causal factors are only indirectly related to the proximate events and conditions preceding the loss. When all the factors, including indirect and systemic ones, are considered, it becomes clear that the maintenance worker was, in fact, only a minor and somewhat irrelevant player in the loss. Instead, degradation in the safety margin occurred over time and without any particular single decision to do so, but simply as a series of decisions that moved the plant slowly toward a situation where any slight error would lead to a major accident. Given the overall state of the Bhopal Union Carbide plant and its operation, if the action of inserting the slip disc had not been left out of the pipe washing operation that December day in 1984, something else would have triggered an accident. In fact, a similar leak had occurred the year before but did not have the same catastrophic consequences, and the true root causes of that incident were neither identified nor fixed. To label one event such as a maintenance worker leaving out the slip disc or even several events as the root cause or the start of an event chain leading to the Bhopal accident is misleading at best. Rasmussen writes, "The stage for an accidental course of events very likely is prepared through time by the normal efforts of many actors in their respective daily work context, responding to the standing request to be more productive and less costly. Ultimately, a quite normal variation in somebody's behavior can then release an accident. Had this root cause been avoided by some additional safety measure, the accident would very likely be released by another cause at another point in time. In other words, an explanation of the accident in terms of events, acts, and errors is not very useful for design of improved systems. In general, event-based models are poor at representing systemic accident factors such as structural deficiencies in the organization, management decision-making, and flaws in the safety culture of the company or industry. An accident model should encourage a broad view of accident mechanisms that expands the investigation beyond the proximate events. A narrow focus on technological components and pure engineering activities, or a similar narrow focus on operator errors, may lead to ignoring some of the most important factors in terms of preventing future accidents. The accident model used to explain why the accident occurred should not only encourage the inclusion of all the causal factors but should provide guidance in identifying these factors." Footnote. Union Carbide lawyers argued that the introduction of water into the MIC tank was an act of sabotage rather than a maintenance worker's mistake. While this differing interpretation of the initiating event has important implications with respect to legal liability, it makes no difference in the argument presented here regarding the limitations of event chain models of accidents or even, as will be seen, understanding why this accident occurred. Section 225. Including systems factors in accident models. Larger scale engineered systems are more than just a collection of technological artifacts. They are a reflection of the structure, management, procedures, and culture of the engineering organization that created them. They are usually also a reflection of the society in which they were created. Ralph Miles, J.R. in describing the basic concepts of systems theory, notes, underlying every technology is at least one basic science, although the technology may be well developed long before the science emerges. Overlying every technical or civil system is a social system that provides purpose, goals, and decision criteria. Effectively preventing accidents in complex systems requires using accident models that include that social system as well as the technology and its underlying science. Without understanding the purpose, goals, and decision criteria used to construct and operate systems, it is not possible to completely understand and most effectively prevent accidents. Awareness of the importance of social and organizational aspects of safety goes back to the early days of system safety. 7. In 1968, Jerome Lederer, then the director of the NASA manned flight safety program for Apollo, wrote, "System safety covers the total spectrum of risk management. It goes beyond the hardware and associated procedures of system safety engineering. It involves attitudes and motivation of designers and production people, employee/management rapport, the relation of industrial associations among themselves and with government, human factors in supervision and quality control, documentation on the interfaces of industrial and public safety with design and operations, the interest and attitudes of top management, the effects of the legal system on accident investigations and exchange of information, the certification of critical workers, political considerations, resources, public sentiment, and many other non-technical but vital influences on the attainment of an acceptable level of risk control. These non-technical aspects of system safety cannot be ignored. Too often, however, these non-technical aspects are ignored. At least three types of factors need to be considered in accident causation. The first is the proximate event chain, which for the Herald of Free Enterprise includes the assistant boatswains not closing the doors and the return of the first officer to the wheelhouse prematurely. Note that there was a redundant design here, with the first officer checking the work of the assistant boatswain, but it did not prevent the accident, as is often the case with redundancy. The second type of information includes the conditions that allowed the events to occur, the high spring tides, the inadequate design of the ferry loading ramp for this harbor, and the desire of the first officer to stay on schedule, thus leaving the car deck before the doors were closed. All of these conditions can be directly mapped to the event's tions, but these indirect factors are critical in fully understanding why the accident occurred and thus how to prevent future accidents. In this case, the systemic factors include the owner of the ferry Townsend Fawzen needing ships that were designed to permit fast loading and unloading and quick acceleration in order to remain competitive in the ferry business, and pressure by company management on the captain and first officer to strictly adhere to schedules, also related to competitive factors. Several attempts have been made to graft systemic factors onto event models, but all have important limitations. The most common approach has been to add hierarchical levels above the event chain. In the 70s, Johnson proposed a model and sequencing method that described accidents as chains of direct events and causal factors arising from contributory factors, which in turn arise from systemic factors. Figure 2.7. Johnson also tried to put management factors into fall trees, a technique called MORT, or Management Oversight Risk Tree, but ended up simply providing a general checklist for auditing management practices. While such a checklist can be very useful, it presupposes that every error can be predefined and put into a checklist form. The checklist is comprised of a set of questions that should be asked during an accident investigation. Examples of the questions from a DOE MORT user's manual are: was there sufficient training to update and improve needed supervisory skills? Did the supervisors have their own technical staff or access to such individuals? Was their technical support of the right discipline S sufficient for the needs of supervisory programs and review functions? Were there established methods for measuring performance that permitted the effectiveness of supervisory programs to be evaluated? Was a maintenance plan provided?